here and have several witnesses with you, if you'd like to bring them up.
Thank you, Chair Menas and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Ringo and Senator Walker and Senator Starr and high and learned council friends. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North in Salem at 97303, and I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes major portions of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. And I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 613. Mr. Chair, under the leadership of this Judiciary Committee back in 1999, we were instrumental in passing Senate Bill 482, and I'm not going to go into that, but at this time, I think it was introduced by Senator Cliff Trow, involved what we were starting to pick up then is problems with sports activities in our society and the threat that was being posed to game officials. Well, since then, as some of you know or may not know, and some of you may not even be interested, I have spent a lot of years in youth sports as a coach as well as on some of their boards. And while I've stopped doing that about a year or so ago, it has been my perception as a result of my involvement there, plus the fact that I still have boys in sports in the high school level, so I attend their functions, as well as my role at Western Oregon University, where I'm involved with the athletics at that institution, that things are starting to happen in a way that is a serious threat to not only those that are participating in the sports activities, but those that are particularly in officiating. And sure enough, in USA Today, in the February 14th edition, in a major article, "Officials Under Assault, Verbal and Physical Abuse is on the Rise at All Levels of Sports." Now, when this bill was scheduled, I think yesterday I was told it was scheduled, I hurriedly tried to get together some witnesses because I thought I had read that the town and city of Sherwood had, in a dramatic fashion, and I was blown away by this because I usually think of the federal level, the state level. Here was this community of Sherwood, and I'm familiar with it because my boys have played soccer up in that area, was considering an ordinance to deal with the actions of parents and others in youth sports or in sports in general. So we found out, we contacted the mayor of Sherwood, who quickly has come down this morning to join us. He is here. I started to go through the litany of individuals that I'm familiar with in terms of my sports contact to try to get someone to represent sports officials at the college level and at the high school level so that we could start to hear from them. Sure enough, I've been very, very pleased today that I was able at the last moment to get the number two person at the OSAA. He is sitting to my right. He is the former captain of Western Oregon University's football team 100 years ago. He also was a football star 100 years before that in Baker City. So I'm very familiar with this individual, both in terms of his conduct on the field as an athlete, which I do not want to go into, but also in terms of his knowledge and his expertise in all sports, at least the high school level. I'm also fortunate to have with me today an individual who was willing to come at the last minute, who's in charge of all officials for the small colleges in the Idaho, Washington, and Oregon area. Small colleges being the NCAA Division III, NAIA Division II, and all community colleges. He is here to join with us today. Then we have the Honorable, the Mayor of Sherwood, who came down this morning to speak about his ordinance that he's working very hard on and his community is. Now, this bill, which is drafted, Mr. Chair, in no particular way, is more as a disincentive or preventive measures. And I will tell you, at this time, this country's at war, and we've got budget difficulties, I know that the importance of this may not seem that significant. But I can tell you that if you are involved with sports, as I am, in the high school level, as I just was in the youth level, and you're involved with the PA announcing, as I do, I public address announce all the men and women's basketball games at Western Oregon University. So I am sitting right next to coaches, and I have fans all around me. It is unbelievable, unbelievable what is happening in terms of spectators, parents, in terms of what is being said to players, and what is being said to officials, even some coaches, with all due respect. While they're the subject of some of it, they themselves and their conduct is deplorable. So with that opening statement, Mr. Chair, ordinarily, as you may know, I like to prepare a nice written statement, and I like to submit it. To be frank with you, I simply didn't get it done, so I apologize to the committee. I still plan to do it. But I'd now like to turn it over, if you would, Chair Minnis, to the witnesses that have come here at the last moment. And I also want to thank you, Chair Minnis, because I believe you took this out of order, and I apologize for that. I believe we were supposed to be second up, so I want to apologize to you and the committee and to all the members in the audience who came here perhaps for another measure that came up first. So with that, unless you want to come at me real hard with questions, comments, or criticisms, I would like to turn it over to the individuals that are sitting immediately to my right, if I could, Chair Minnis.
All right. Secretary, Senator Walker.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just have one question of the esteemed President. You've made a comment that fans are all around me. Is that fans of yours, or because of your announcing, or fans of the game?
You don't have to answer that. You have the right to remain silent.
Thank you, Chair Minnis. Thank you, Chair Minnis.
Sir, if you just proceed with your name and your testimony.
Sure. My name is Brad Garrett. I'm an assistant executive director with the OSAA. We are located in Wilsonville, Oregon. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 613 this morning.
Go ahead. Okay.
I think you all have a prepared statement that I've left for you there, and I will not read from it, but I want to briefly summarize what is in there. First of all, on behalf of Tom Welter, our executive director, he sends his apologies today. He is unable to attend, and hence my presence. The OSAA is an organization that is made up of 287 public and private high schools around the state of Oregon, and we are the governing body for high school athletics in the state. As a member of the staff, I obviously have a number of responsibilities, one of them being for officials in the state of Oregon in all sports. I am the liaison with between our staff and the sports officials that essentially manage all high school contests in OSAA-sponsored activities around the state during our association year. So as you can imagine, that's a number of different athletic events that go on. As a reminder, officials around our state, we certify over 3,000 officials through our office each year. And those officials are insurance salesmen, construction workers, dentists, lawyers, teachers. It is certainly not an association of professional sports officials. This is an extra job for many people for a number of different reasons. Some to earn a few extra bucks in order to get through college, some for just a little extra spending cash, and certainly for others, and maybe a vast majority, if I could quantify it that way, it's because they're trying to give back to the game they love, and maybe those kids who are participating within those activities now. Well, in my position, obviously, I get a chance to speak with a number of local associations around this state. We have about 115 local associations in 7 different sports. Each of those local associations has a commissioner. Those commissioners report back to me that recruitment and retention issues are really at a critical point within Oregon and around the country. It's tough to keep sports officials. And certainly providing a safe working environment for those officials is a step in the right direction. The safer you feel when out there performing your duties, I imagine it, putting myself in that scenario, and I've never been on the court, and I'm sure your whole testimony from at least Al who speak to that, but essentially there are times when that environment is threatened, and certainly this bill would help to ensure that safety. In closing, I just want to read a short comment that I've included in your materials from Barry Mano, who's the president and the founder of the National Association of Sports Officials. Today, this is a quote, "Today the health of our games is being attacked by a cancer of bad behavior, much of it occurring in full view of our young people who participate in organized sports. We must do something to send a clear signal that such behavior will not be tolerated, and we need to do so for 2 reasons. First, the men and women, boys and girls, who give their time and energy to officiate games not only deserve our collective respect, they must have complete confidence that they will be able to carry out their responsibilities in a safe environment. Second, as a society, we need to act on behalf on the belief that respect for authority, whether you agree with it or not, is critical to living, working, and playing together. Sports needs to be a beacon, highlighting positive accomplishments and the need for sportsmanship and fair play. That was Barry Mano's comment and quote. I respect him tremendously, and just would leave you with the fact that the OSAA certainly supports passing of House Bill 613 and the continued efforts of the legislature to protect sports officials around the state of Oregon. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any of your questions you may have.
All right, questions?
I do have questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
Chairman, I ironically, we were discussing the legislation that we passed in the last legislative session yesterday that added protections to sports officials from assault. But the scenario that I envisioned, having coached T-ball for 7 years in my earlier career, and I've seen some bad behavior, parents bringing their personal issues to the ball fields and engaging in issues unrelated to the sporting contest. Totally inappropriate. But feeling very frustrated because coaches don't have very much ability to control those situations. So if you've got a person who's in the stands as a fan or a parent whose behavior is so egregious that they fall under this triggering mechanism that's in the bill, and then the coach, taking the authority and responsibility conferred by the bill, walks over and says, "You're out of here. You're to the showers. You and your whole family and your player leave the field or be prosecuted for trespass." And I can imagine the person who's already engaged in this disruptive behavior says, "Or what? Or what?" And at that point in time, you put the coach in a situation of the law enforcement officer in a face-to-face confrontation with a belligerent fan or parent or patron. And I want to know, at that point in time, what we expect to happen.
As far as the situation between a coach and a spectator?
Eyeball to eyeball, one of them belligerent and screaming, and the other one trying to restore order.
Well, certainly in the context of high school athletics, and my experience is not only as an athletic director at a high school, Sam Barlow High School in Gresham for 7 years, we try not to, as administrators, put our coaches in those situations to start with.
Boy,
that's really an administrative responsibility. There could be cases where a coach has to deal with those issues, and certainly I think the first priority for any coach, the first priority is to coach their team. Administratively, we're put in those positions often, and I found myself in 7 years at Barlow dealing with disruptive and disgruntled fans for whatever reason on numerous occasions. And I guess the coach has to step to a higher authority at that point in order to remove the situation. And if that doesn't work, well, they have to find some other remedy for it. Certainly, I think what the bill does is give the officials...
The guy in the striped shirt.
Yeah. The option, certainly they have the option under National Federation rules at the high school level. Once they take the court, they have authority. And certainly they can remove a spectator after certain steps are taken with help from the administration at that event. As I understand the bill, this would help prevent that, the thought that that person would come back. Well, I'm going to go away and cool off now, but I'm going to come back later and get after this coach. And this simply says you're not going to do that. You're not going to have that ability, or you're going to face criminal charges.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I think the official now has the authority to call off the game, just suspend the play if there's disruptive behavior. But I guess I just don't understand how that guy in the striped shirt is going to get control of a person who's already over the top in terms of belligerence without some kind of law enforcement assistance or administrative help.
And it very well could include that. There's been occasions in contest play to Barlow where we had to have the school resource officer or, you know, an on-call sheriff come out and help with a presence in order to remove a spectator. It's happened. Happens at high schools around the state every sports season.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Seems like a pretty good bill to me. Thanks for coming here this morning. I did have a question about the definition of location as the bill is written. this bill would allow the game official to remove somebody from the location, which means the facility. And I'm wondering whether there might be some, just an assumption that really is what they're talking about is you have to go to the locker room. So at least you remove yourself from the arena where the fans are and the players are.
And I defer to Peter.
Yeah. If somebody else.
Let me.
If I can address that.
Identify yourself. You have to, please.
Oh, my name is Mark Collins, Mayor of Sherwood, Oregon. I live at, I have to think about this, 235 Sunset, Sherwood, Oregon, 97112. This is actually a bill that I drafted for the city of Sherwood. I think you copy most of it. And we're going through this process, trying to work with the coaches and the officials in this. There's a couple of things that we're going to change in our, and I'll offer those for you, and I can answer both those questions. You would not allow one coach to kick anybody out. You would allow a coach and a referee to kick somebody out, because then we're afraid you're going to get into that match of coach, one coach kicking out your fans, and a coach starting to kick out your fans. So we think officials can take control of this. Second of all, we're looking at this not to have the officials or the coach enforce the rule. All they would do is make the request that the person leaves, and they would call law enforcement. And that's why we pay our law enforcement officers, that it would de-accelerate. We're not looking to accelerate the problem. We're looking to de-accelerate. We're just saying we're going to stop the game until you leave, and then just simply call the police and have them come. And the reason this went anywhere to begin with is I asked our police what would happen if an unruly fan, not in the high school field, because they have different rules, but just at one of our parks, because, you know, in the Oregon system, we're spending millions of dollars on parks and sports, and the justification is that it builds great character, does this, does that for the youth. And then you have a coach of an 8-year-old football team get kicked out for unsportsmanlike conduct, and what has he done to the whole thought process of building strong character in those kids when that happens? He's destroyed it. And I felt uncomfortable investing millions of dollars in parks and allowing inappropriate conduct to diminish the great values sporting contests and parks in general. So the location in here that we were thinking of was the park. Playing at this park, our parks are smaller than other parks, I suppose. We have a 20-acre park. We have two fields there. You're removed from the park. That's the location. High school, I would assume that if you're removed from the high school-owned property. You wanted, the whole goal here is to remove them from the problem.
No, that's fine. Mr. Chair, no, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure that that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about, let's say we're talking about a basketball game in some arena. It's not, you go to the locker room and stay there till the game is over. It's, you have to leave the building.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Any other questions?
Alan.
Any other persons wishing to testify here?
Alan.
Yes, my name is Alan Moberg, and I reside at 329 McNary Estates Drive North in Kaiser, Oregon. And I'm here representing an organization called Tri-States Intercollegiate Basketball Officials Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before the committee and in full support of this particular bill for a variety of reasons. The bottom line, to cut the story short, is I simply feel that it's nothing but a ticking time bomb before something serious happens in our sports world. I can tell you many stories about things that are happening in basketball games, but I am a sports fan and watch football, basketball, soccer, Little League baseball, all sports, and the behavior from our spectators and fans is absolutely deplorable. It goes from parent down to father, daughter, son. We have little kids now that are picking up on this kind of behavior, and it's a recognition thing, and where it seems as though adverse behavior attracts a lot of attention. Specifically with sports officials, I have told my people, and I have 160 college basketball referees that I am responsible for, and they are instructed not to deal with an unruly spectator, but rather to go directly to game management and have this person removed from the facility. But that really isn't good enough sometimes, because one particular championship basketball game in Klamath Falls years ago. Two spectators were removed, and sports officials went after they left the building, went to leave. Their car was overturned in the parking lot. So I'm not sure just how far we can go with the penalty phase of this thing, but certainly the way it is right now, there's very little deterrence for adverse behavior. The other thing that is of great concern to sports officials, and that is the adverse behavior that is displayed towards players themselves from fans and parents. And as an example, we have several kids from student bodies that actually attempt to come out on the floor to berate, belittle, demean sports officials and players. Sports officials, we absolutely don't tolerate that. We go directly to game management, but it is happening towards other players as well. And it's a situation where I believe, seriously believe, in the very near future that it could lead to rioting in the stands with spectators and fans, and certainly is going to become a problem if it's not dealt with. I appreciate the opportunity to give you this information and entertain any questions you may have.
Yes, Senator Brady.
Well, I want to thank all of you for bringing this bill. I think it is a sad commentary that we have to be taking measures like this. My daughter was involved in soccer and basketball when she was younger, and we had a very strong ethic among the parents that this behavior was not tolerated. We managed in our circumstance to keep a lid on it. And it's just, I hate hearing these stories because it sends such a bad message. But my question is, the scenario that you mentioned involves kind of a group of people, as I hear you, you know, demeaning the players or whatever. Under current law, does the game official have the ability to call off the game where you're dealing with a big group like this? Because I can't see this bill necessarily being adequate to handle that situation.
From an OSAA perspective with high school sports, certainly the principal, the administrators that are present, if we end up with a situation that is out of control, certainly they can agree to terminate the game, okay, under OSAA rules. The official himself, or a pair of officials working a contest, or a crew of officials, We try to work together as a team. We never try to isolate any single individual to make those decisions. Certainly we work together between game management, game officials, administrators if they're different than game management, to make a decision on what the course of action to take in case we have chaos, breakout, you know, at a high school contest, which, to my recollection, I cannot think of a game that's been terminated for that reason. Usually local school administrators take the steps necessary to deal with those issues. Now, Al works at the collegiate level. That could be a little different in most respects. And not to say that our high school crowds are the best sportsmen in the world, because that would be an incorrect statement. Certainly some schools are better than others. But they do have essentially people in place to take care of those issues. So it's a group decision rather than an individual just saying this game's over.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just comment that certainly the enforcement of this measure, if it makes its way through the process, will certainly be a teachable moment for kids. I guess the comment that disturbs me most is that kids are picking up this kind of behavior that's being modeled for them. And to see this being enforced against their coach or against an unruly parent would be a very good teachable moment, in my view.
All right. I want to make sure I understand what we're doing here, and it seems relatively simple to me. What we're doing is clarifying in statute that the game official would have the authority, or the authority would be vested in that person, to order a person to leave. Now, the crime occurs when the person fails to leave. So really what we're doing is we're saying that this person has the authority to govern who's present at one of these events based on their view of the conduct. And that power exists currently for anybody who exercises control over their property, their home, or a business. And so really that's all we're doing is making an extension of that statutory authority, clarifying. I mean, a building official at a high school could or would also have that authority, but I guess my experience is that oftentimes in school events or large events, there's not one single person who really knows who has the authority organizationally to say, you can't be here. So in this sense, it clarifies who does have that. Now, today on the Senate floor, I'm carrying a bill that fixes the Collins decision, assuming that it gets through the building. And the Collins decision created a number of problems that if a person trespassed someone off of their business or their home, that if that person returned within 5 minutes, and then they actually left, but then they returned 5 minutes later, you'd have to order them again, and you have a series of subsequent crimes that occur based on each order of the person to leave. So hopefully that gets fixed, and then that will clarify that once this person's ordered to leave, they'd have to leave. But then it also raises another question that I'm not sure of, and that is that assuming we fix Collins, and a game official trespasses someone off of a game, at what point does the trespass or that particular authority extinguish? Because if you're the owner of the property, you can, with a Collins fix, you would be able to say in perpetuity, this person may no longer come on my premise or to my home. But in this sense, there's a time at which the game ends. And it's something in law, I think, has to say that this order has to cease. You got to say again, gentlemen from.
This is Mark Caldwell again. In the ordinance that we were looking at, some of the additions that we've had is we had that same question. What we just wrote in is for the remainder of the day. And so it made it a specific amount of time. We just didn't want that person on our park property for the rest of that day. And that way, the question comes up, well, how do you govern it if you come back 6 hours later? We don't care, to be honest with you. Right. Game's over, just the rest of the day.
All right. And I'm saying, I think, for the community council, it seems to me it would need to be clarified to some degree. And then it looks to me like we're creating a B misdemeanor in this conduct, and current statute for criminal trespass is also a B misdemeanor.
Mr. Chairman, criminal trespass in the second degree, which would be the applicable statute, is a C misdemeanor. That's a 30 days maximum.
Right.
And, Mr. Chairman, on your discussion on the Collins fix, that references the definition of enter or remain unlawfully, you'll recall.
All right.
From that discussion on Senate Bill, is it 46 or 64, I can't remember which.
46.
And that language is not in this bill, so I don't think there would be that much of a crossover.
All right, good. So the question, Mr. President, is whether or not a Class B misdemeanor allows for a probable cause arrest. Class C misdemeanors do not. They have to occur in the presence of the police officer. Is it your intent to create a probable cause element in this or not? Or is it something that would be envisioned to occur in the presence of a police officer who has the...
Chairman, no, I don't think... I need to think about that. It's like all of a sudden I'm on the Judiciary Committee again, and I just can't respond to that right now. I want to make good law. I want to say one thing, if I can, Chairman. Senator Ferriero got at the point. I want to tell you something. If you even look at this, if this was even to become law or some part of it, the beauty of it is it's there. If you have to invoke it a lot, then I'll tell you something. You put your life on the line every day as a police officer. I mean, you're dealing with people murdering people and raping people. I am fully aware of what is going on in the state of Oregon today in terms of how important this is versus other things. You know what I do? Every game, if I have a Great Northwest Athletic Conference game at Western, two teams competing, I read a statement prior to the game. But I'll tell you something. At the end of that statement, I should say, everyone in the stands should be aware that the state of Oregon has passed legislation that says the following, criminal trespass. I'll guarantee you, everything I read in that statement, that alone would be chilling, if you know what I mean. That is significant. And I would assume the OSAA, if this would make a statement, be read opening, as well as the small colleges. If we have to enforce this on any kind of regular basis, then it's not going to be enforced,
Chairman. I said, you know what I mean? Because the police officers, they're responding to crimes that are much more serious. The DAs are prosecuting. But to make a major policy statement at this time, the state of Oregon feels that this conduct is so deplorable and increasing to such an extent that they're going to create a crime is the critical thing. My answer to you is, I don't know what to do about your Class B, Class C statement. I need to think about it. I don't think I want probable cause because then it gets complicated. But I could be wrong, Chair Minnis, if you know what I'm saying. I mean, John, I just can't answer right now.
I just want to make sure that if we do pass the bill out, that it's pretty sound and it's going to be a penalty.
No, I understand, and you're absolutely right.
Okay. Counsel, you have any wisdom for me here?
Mr. Chairman, I'm also looking at the statutes real quickly to make sure I give you the right answer, so I'll do that.
Okay. All right. I think we have some, I don't know if we have other folks signed up to testify here or not. Mr. Powell, we do not. And was there a reason that we didn't couple to existing criminal trespass statutes, or we seem to be creating a separate?
All I know to say is, I'll be frank with you, Chair Minnis. I asked, let's say, the council to draft a bill based on what Truro was attempting to do, because I had the feeling they had done a lot of this thinking, and that's all I know. And so let's say LC came up with this draft. I don't want to put them on the spot.
I had a little tourism bill on. Had the same problem.
Okay, well, I'm sorry I can't do better in answering your very thoughtful and very difficult questions.
That was actually a joke. I was talking about my terrorism bill.
Well, you know, can I just say something? I want to say that I'm sorry I had to be the first public hearing on the morning following a very difficult evening for you, if you know what I mean, and I'm sorry about that.
All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick Farrelly.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask counsel's opinion. We are considering a fix to the Collins decision, which would address the circumstance of somebody returning after they've been ordered off the premises. I wanted to get the council's opinion on whether this sort of thing would be more comfortable within that particular bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, would the Collins case, the Collins case was a interpretation of what enter or remain unlawfully means. I think the issue for this type of bill, where there's a referee or umpire, is what I think the gentleman have brought up. You need to make it clear, perhaps, who the person in charge is who has the right to trespass someone from a public premises. And so either making that clear in the trespass to or doing this would do the same thing. And as long as the Collins case is what the public policy wants, which Chairman Minnis referred to, is that the Collins decision, I believe, made it such that if a person did trespass a person from property and then that person came back, you could not arrest that person and take them away. You'd have to say again, you must leave. And if they left again and they came back, you'd have to say you must leave, and they would fail to do so. So I think there's two ways to go with this, and certainly either one is fine. So I don't think there's an overlap legally, but I think you could get to trespassing them through either avenue, if that makes sense.
Well, if they're all equal, then I would think I would prefer to have it in the sports statute for the reasons that Senator Courtney gave, which is it's out there in the sports statute,
right,
as something that they can announce at the beginning of the game. And people who are involved as referees and coaches will be reading that statute anyway.
Right.
So if they're all equal, I would recommend them there.
Right. And I get Senator Farrelly and Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I want to come at this from a different angle. I absolutely support the concept. I think it's unfortunate, but there's slob behavior everywhere, and we're rewarding slob behavior. If you doubt that, tune into WWF sometime. If you can stand it. Is there an implied contractual agreement between fans and officials, or fans and the venue, when the officials or the venue agree to hold a sporting contest and the fan attends the contest? And in that contractual relationship, is there some way to require the fan or the participant to accept the conduct of behavior? And what I'm looking at is that contestants in a sporting contest agree by participating to be bound by the rules of the sport and the judgments and the rulings of the officials. And the contestants know that if they violate the rules, they're subject to sanction, including ejection from the game. We don't seem to have sort of an echo in the fans, but I'm wondering if that if the school venue or the sporting venue or the league venue agrees to hold a sporting contest and provide officiation and structure, that fans, by attending, are entering into an implied contract that they, in fact, have agreed to attend this, which has specific behavioral limitations. And I guess that, you know, that's the one question. The other question I want you to noodle over for me is, in these contests, and I've been coaching an official and participant, very often the officials will not be the witnesses to what precipitates bad behavior. And typically in a group of people, you've got a very emotional response to slob behavior. And somebody will usually stand up and say, that's unacceptable, get the officials. And there's a mini confrontation between fans surrounding. And the official isn't going to know who started this thing, and may eject the wrong person or persons. And would that official be therefore subject to a liability for having ejected the wrong party? Is that a wrongful deprivation of some civil right? Is there going to be some liability for enforcing this that could attend to the official? And if not, do we need to build a provision? I mean, that's where I'm going with this whole concept that there's an implied conduct contract by fans attending an official game. And that we may need to protect the official from exercising this authority if, in the heat of the moment, he basically just says everybody that's in confrontation has to leave the stadium, when in fact some of those people or parents may be trying to restore order. And how do we deal with those two issues? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator Starr.
I'd like an answer, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, you want an answer? I thought you'd just given a dissertation like I do.
Absolutely. I can tell you, sure, with sports parents, not in a high school, but in a little kid's sports, we're forcing them to actually go through a sportsmanship program, and if their kid's going to play, they're going to sign a contract with this thing and abide by the rules.
Okay, well, you can't do that with all the fans.
And I understand that. And I really think that you raised some good issues for liability that has to be worked through council.
I think the issue is would be the very same as if someone walks into a Meyer and Frank store and they're shopping and they engage in conduct that's offensive to the owner of the store, the person that has control of the property, and that person then says, you have to leave my store. I am in a position of authority to tell you to leave. They really don't have to give them a specific reason.
Mr. Chair, I get that, but what if the owner of the store in that situation says to the person causing the disruption that they have to leave, plus the person next to him that wasn't doing anything?
Well, then I think they've got some civil liability issues that they might have to ultimately face. I mean, there have been cases, by the way, and I'm not an attorney, but I do know of cases in the Portland metro area where law enforcement have been ordered to arrest someone based on a restaurant owner's, you know, probable or their arrest, and throw them out of a restaurant, and lo and behold, they end up getting sued, so and successfully so.
That's the very nature of why we came up with this, is if you ask the police, how do you control, how do you do it when you show up and there are problems? Well, we either have to observe unruly behavior, or somebody has to swear out of a
sign the custody report. Mm-hmm.
So that's how we wanted to make it more certain. But the beauty of this, I believe, is that the crime doesn't occur until the person comes back on the property or refuses to leave. So if they throw me out wrongfully, all I have to do is remove myself from the premises and go talk to somebody else about the situation. But no crimes occur until I refuse to obey the instructions or I come back on the property. I'm in control of whether the rest are not going to cite me for a crime. He's going to tell me the truth. I control whether I've committed a crime or not.
Right. Is it okay?
I guess I can see at some point in time the good Senator Courtney mentioned that he does read a statement or would read a statement in these sporting contests. I think creating the impression or at least informing the crowd that there is an implied power, I'm wondering if we don't need to just make an explicit in law the implied contract between fans and sporting venues that if they show up, they're going to abide by the rulings of the officials. And if they don't, then they're in breach of contract. But I also think we have to confer some liability protection to officials that exercise these orders, because otherwise, in the heat of the moment, the wrong people are going to get ejected. There's going to be videotape. There's going to be a civil rights cause that's created, and we need to protect people from the cause of action that might arise from a bad judgment or a situation where they eject the wrong people.
Right. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Mayor Cottle for bringing this to us, and I'm intrigued by his comments that there are some modifications that they have considered since the drafting of this measure, and would like to hear further about those proposed changes that he might make. I'm very supportive of the bill as drafted. But if there's some improvements, they've obviously put a lot more time in it than we have.
All right.
I appreciate that. Our committees are looking at it right now. We're trying to build a consensus. We're trying to do an educational program. I think they've taken care of some of our concerns. I think the concern that's brought this bill to you is doing a good deed for Oregon. And I really think that if we just focus on this is a methodology for us to restore or maintain order, in the sense that they're all focused on college and high school. I'm more worried about the 8-year-olds and the 9-year-olds, and I've got a 13-year-old coaching or reffing the game. And how do you give those people authority to say, I need some help here? And there was no statute or ordinance anywhere in the United States that gave them any help. I found out once we started them. So, and I really think this gives them that help. It just gives them, all they have to do is call 911, the police officer shows up, the kid has to say, you know, I got people screaming. And the police officer can just say, you asked them, please. Yes, I have. That takes care of it. Yes, accelerates the problem, it takes care of the situation. And that's my focus, is trying to keep those 14, 15, and 16-year-old kids in having to put a very uncomfortable situation sometimes. And it's getting worse and worse.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions? I think, Senator Courtney, what we're going to do here, council would like to take a little time to look at Section 3 or subsection 3 of Section 1. And the issue, I think, that is connected to what Senator Farioli raised, and that is the implied contract or the speech issues, the free speech issues. Are there any free speech issues? At what point does, you know, someone say something that, you know, I don't like the ref, the ref's an idiot, and the ref then says, you're out of here, you've got to leave, they refuse to leave. And is that sufficient to be a basis for a criminal charge, or is it really free speech? And I don't know the answer to that question at this point, but I think we want some clarification to those issues and how that's defined and if it's defined narrowly enough. And then the other issue I think that was raised was when does it toll? When does this power to restrict the person's access to the facility stop? And are there other issues that we think those are the two? And I think we get this thing back and clarify it. And there we go. Comments, Senator?
Chairman, I just want to say I'm really grateful to even consider this bill. I know that you're dealing with very serious issues. Your plate's full. I just think it's great you do this, and the committee's just been wonderful. And I can't say enough things about this. I never met this mayor before, but I tell you, it's a gutsy thing, sure, what you're trying to do. And then to bring in Alan Moberg, just came in a moment's notice, talking about the college officials. Then Brad came down from spring break, left his 6-year-old daughter. She's daddy's girl. I'm just very grateful to you. And as I say, Senator Farioli said something that really rivets to me. I am sorry I have to even bring in this bill. We should not have to have this kind of legislation. We shouldn't need this kind of legislation, but I don't know what to do. I mean, we should be behaving ourselves, but we're not behaving ourselves. And so I don't know whether we just say that's life, people don't behave themselves, we'll live with it, or do we try to send a signal. So I'm sorry we even have to take up your time about this, but I tell you, it's bad. And just thank you very much, Senator. I know you've had a very difficult, I mean this, and I think you know what I'm saying, difficult last night in particular. So I know your sense, and I can watch your body language. We've been together since B.C. You're not happy, and I'm sorry I have to be the first up to go before you, especially since I'm not sure you love this bill, since you told me you're not, and I understand it. So I'm just really grateful you'd even look at this
issue. I'm just happy that my committee loves me.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 613. Thank you very much for coming. And then let me see what you do I have here. Yes, Senate Bill 553, Senator Walker, this is your bill. I don't know how you want to proceed, but let me know.
I will give you and the committee a brief history of why the bill has come forward, and then my constituent would be the next appropriate witness, and then all those who are signed up after that.
All right. You can stay here, you can go there, you can dance a jig, I don't care.
Okay, great. Well, I'll just stay right here. For the record, my name is Vicki Walker. I'm a state senator for District 7, Eugene and Junction City. Senate Bill 553, members of the committee and Mr. Chair, is brought to you because I have a constituent who will be testifying, and his name is Carlos Cartledge, and he is concerned that we currently do not do background checks on host organizations. Host organizations are those organizations that facilitate the sponsoring of foreign exchange students coming to and from our country, from other countries. And Mr. Cartledge is concerned that we may have some criminal elements who are slipping into the system and hosting foreign exchange students. So he felt that the way to approach this was to require background checks. I had a visit from the American Field Service folks into my office with Mr. Cartledge present, and we discussed this bill, and they brought to my attention that background checks in and of themselves do not really necessarily weed out the good and the bad. And they brought to my attention another program that is in existence, several programs at the federal level, that coordinate and actually work quite well, and they will be here to discuss those. One of the things I'd like to tell you is that there's an organization called the Council on Standards for International Educational Travel, and you will see in your packet, so I asked the director of that program to send me information. His name is John Hishmay, and he has two letters in the file. One on top tells you about the history of background checks and his experience when he worked for the State Department. He was actually a program officer with oversight responsibility for the J-1 visa high school program. And the J-1 visa, you'll see I have an attachment there that explains that. It is for high school students. And he was working in the State Department at the time in the 1990s when the state of California was looking at requiring background checks. And they came to the conclusion that that really was not going to work, and that the programs that are set in place with the Council on Standards for International Educational Travel and the other organizations that exist actually will protect folks in the long run. So in that vein, I had the -2 amendments drafted. The -2 amendments replace the entire bill and sets up a registration program with the Secretary of State's office. This is a bill that's exactly a duplicate of an existing Washington State statute that has been in place since 1991, and it works quite well, and the AFS folks who are here this morning will testify about that. And if I could just kind of run through the amendments and let you know how they would work. The host organization...
Yeah, just one second.
Yes.
I'm going to go into a quick work session on 553, and Senator Burdick would accommodate an adoption of the -2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 553.
All right, Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 553. Is there any discussion? Any objections? There are none. So now that is the official document in front of us.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. In the -2s, the first section explains to you what a foreign exchange student is and what a host organization is. Section 2 indicates that the host organization would be registered with the Secretary of State. I have the Secretary of State's office is here, and we'll talk about how that impacts their office. They will submit an application. The application will be reviewed by the Secretary of State, and that application, the standards will be established by the Secretary of State's office to take into consideration standards established by the United States Information Agency and the Council on Standards for International Educational Travel. And you'll find that at page 3, lines 12 through 17 in the amendments. And then the Secretary of State would approve or not approve the application and the registration, and then that would be renewed each year. There is, on page 4 of the amendments, a person who willfully and knowingly provides false or incorrect information is guilty of a class blank misdemeanor. That's a fill-in-the-blank for our committee. And also in Section 3 of the bill, on page 4 of the amendments, the Secretary of State would provide annually to the Superintendent of Public Instruction a list of all those organizations who are registered. And Section 4 of the bill indicates that list would be made available to school boards and school districts. Section 5 would also create a penalty for anyone who gives incorrect information regarding their organization. I think this is a really good place to go, and I'm very appreciative that Senator Starr is on our committee as he chairs the Education Committee and can really provide us some insight here. If you have an opportunity to read the first letter from Mr. Hishmay, on the back of it, he gives a brief history of the organization CSIET, and that there was heightened sensitivity toward exchange of students in the 1980s. And so a commission was put together, and they looked at how to resolve that. And as a result, the International Youth Exchange Office of the State Department commissioned a study, and the study revealed the lack of industry-wide standards. In response to that, the Council on Standards for International Educational Travel was created to uphold new standards. And it's a fabulous organization, as I've come to learn from reading the material. Two things are at issue here. The folks from AFS believe that the problem we have with host organizations in the state are those who are not registered with CSIET or those who are not registered with anyone. We have host organizations in the state who have offices outside of the state of Oregon, and it creates problems. My constituent believes that CSIET registration is a good idea, but he still insists that we should have background checks. So I believe that this committee should actually listen to that testimony and understand his concerns. The ACLU will have objection, and I did draft a Dash 1 amendment to address those objections, but my constituent did not want to go forward with those. So with that, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, I would invite testimony so we could have a discussion on this issue this morning.
Thank you, Senator Walker. At this time, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 553 as amended and open a hearing on Senate Bill 553 as amended. We'll call Carlos Cartledge. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Chairman, great. My name is Carlos Cartledge. I live in Eugene, Oregon, 2851 Harlow Road. I'm not affiliated with any organization. I'm a retired parole officer. During the last 3 years of my career in Lane County, I supervised exclusively sex offenders. That's how this issue was made important to me. My wife and I have also hosted foreign students for over 20 years. We've been disappointed that the host organizations haven't checked us out. I mean, we've made written application to be hosts of foreign students. Only one time during that 20-year period have we ever been visited to check out our home. to see what kind of living situation it is, to see who's residing in the home. I'm really glad that most applicants to be host families, they're good people, most. And I don't want to exaggerate the problem. But during that three-year period that I was supervised sex offenders, during 2 years, of that time on my job, I found five separate instances where hosts that applied for were predatory sex offenders that applied for and been accepted as hosts. On four of those occasions, kids were actually placed in the homes. I could tell you some horrible stories, but I think we all know the behavior of predatory sex offenders.
Could I ask you, how did you find out this information?
By direct knowledge. Direct knowledge supervising sex offenders in Lane County.
I see, because of your job.
Yes, ma'am. We know that programs that youth programs are a magnet for predatory sex offenders. And we know that Boy Scouts and school districts, sports programs, the OSAA does criminal history checks of sports officials. I might have called that last witness as a support. I support CSIET regulations. Thank you. This industry is largely unregulated. There's many, many organizations here in Oregon that don't fall under the standards of CSIET. Those are good standards as far as they go. But those standards do not include criminal history checks. Now, the providers will tell you that they interview the applicants, that they visit the homes regularly, that they take every measure they know of to ensure that kids are not hurt. I don't mean to criticize that effort. I think these host organizations are a good thing. They provide a good service. But I think it's naive to assume that you're doing the best job possible of protecting kids here in Oregon without doing criminal history checks. Now, it's true the value of criminal history checks, they're existent because they're a useful tool of law enforcement, and they're a useful tool of a lot of other kid-serving organizations that want to protect kids. It's easy to do. Mr. Larry Rutter, he has a business that provides for criminal history checks in Portland. He's here today. He can assure you that it's an easy process. It's no great burden on any organization to do a criminal history check. In some cases, the cost is down as low as $1.50 per name. There's no great burden placed there in terms of work to do. I see the organizations keeping a list of their hosts and verification that the criminal history check has been done. That's all they need to do. It's not that hard. In terms of the Department of Education, they've expressed no opposition to this bill. Provides a user fee. It's actually revenue to the state. To pay for criminal history checks, whether provided by private organizations or the state police. State police costs are larger. That could be $45 to $55 per applicant. But if an organization wants to go to that extent, that would be even better. The data systems that the private companies use are collected from, I believe, all the western states. I'll let Mr. Rutter testify to that.
Thank you. I did have a question of Senator Walker. It's my understanding that the amendments don't require a background check. They require a declaration. Is that correct?
Senator Burdick, Madam Chair, the amendments do not require a background check. That is the difference that we have here, is that in my discussions with the host organizations, they felt that we don't need that, and Mr. Cartlidge feels that we do. So that's the policy discussion that I would like this committee to engage in.
Well, I guess what I'd like to know is, given that, do you support a declaration if that's all we're able to get in this bill?
A declaration on the application?
Yes, the declaration. Have you seen the amendments that we adopted today?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so this requires a declaration that someone does not have a criminal history, and it gets a penalty for lying on that declaration. I mean, is that something that you support?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Are you done with your testimony?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Ringo.
All right, thank you. I guess I'd just like to explore this question a little bit more, if the issue is the background checks or no background checks. You think the background checks get us more? You want there to be background checks, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, but explain to me, explain to the committee exactly what kind of information we'll get from background checks that make it worth it for us to impose that requirement.
Well, those of us who've worked in law enforcement know that past behavior is an indication of future behavior, future problems. The same arguments for this could be used by Boy Scouts, church organizations, organizations that already do criminal history checks to ensure the safety of their kids. I just want to add that these kids, these foreigners coming into our country, some come from cultures where they're very reluctant to report. That makes them especially vulnerable. I'm not saying a huge amount of kids go back home with a negative experience. It's just that a significant amount do. I talked with the FBI Quantico special agent who compiles statistics on sex offenses, and he's saying that they don't have hard data, but they have been hearing anecdotal evidence of this strategy being used by pedophiles all over the United States.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there other committee questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, we will take Thomas Winston Morgan. Thank you. State your name for the record, please. Thank you.
Absolutely. My name is Thomas Winston Morgan. I am the Northwest Regional Field Manager with AFS Intercultural Programs. I live at 1006 Southeast 47th Avenue in Portland. Madam Vice Chair, distinguished members of the judiciary, I appreciate the opportunity this morning to speak about this bill, 553. A little bit of background about AFS, the American Field Service. We have been in existence as an organization since World War I, and we've been operating continuous foreign exchange programs with high school kids since 1947. Each year, we exchange more than 10,000 students, young adults, and teachers internationally between our 54 partner countries. We are arguably the oldest, most long-standing foreign exchange program in the country. In terms of our volunteer network, and we are basically a volunteer-based organization, only the International Red Cross has more international volunteers than AFS. AFS supports the intent of 553. Our number one operational goal is the safety of all of our constituents, and that means our foreign exchange students, both the ones who come from other countries to the United States and those U.S. kids who go abroad, our host families, our volunteers, and our staff. But we disagree with the effect that 553 would have in that it duplicates existing federal efforts to which Senator Walker has already alluded. Number two, the background checks are not the most effective and efficient way to ensure student safety, and that Senate Bill 553 would in fact cost the state of Oregon and exchange programs an unknown amount. In terms of the duplication of effort already in place, Senator Walker has already talked about CSIET, the regulatory agency under which reputable organizations like AFS operate. As the Northwest Regional Manager, I have the opportunity to go to different Northwest states and work with school administrators at the district and school level, and AFS is held in very high regard. In Washington State, for example, only those organizations that are registered with CSIET may operate in that state. We are also under the, as a J-1 issuing organization, we are also under the regulation of the U.S. State Department and the Bureau of Citizen and Immigration Services. It's formerly the INS, but under the new Homeland Security Act, it's now changed its name. As part of the Bureau of Citizen and Immigration Services, there's a tracking system called CVIS, which tracks all of the host family information as well as the international student information, their arrival times, their departures, where they are at all times, even if they leave the host family for a period of a week. We believe that the best way to ensure constituent safety in an international exchange organization is the vast network of local volunteers that we have all over the world. There's a very rigorous process involved in becoming an AFS exchange student. Not all organizations operate this way, but there are a number of reputable organizations, and AFS is one of them. This level of scrutiny is throughout the process. The screening at the beginning for all people getting involved in the organization, the selection of participants, and perhaps most importantly, the continuous local contact that goes on throughout the period of the exchange. Unlike the organizations that Mr. Cartlidge was talking about, AFS doesn't have those issues because we are mandated by CSIET to have a liaison for every student who is placed in the United States. They must document, this liaison must meet with the student and document this contact at a minimum of once a month. Students always know who their liaison is and who the local volunteers are. And it's this mandated network of local support that really separates the reputable organizations from those that are not operating in the same way. Part of what this the Dash 2 would do via CSIET would actually allow random auditing by CSIET, and that's the way CSIET operates. Our records are open to them. They can look at any hosting situation they choose to make sure that the contact has been made, that it's been documented, and that the student and the host family and the volunteers and staff have been supported. Number two, we believe that background checks are not the most effective and efficient way to ensure student safety. Again, this goes back to the network of local support that is so key in a successful foreign exchange program.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Can I ask a question just on that point?
Please.
You know, your statement that they're not the most effective way, that may be true, but still, if they're one effective tool, then why shouldn't we use them as a tool?
There are a number of reasons, and they concern mostly the kind of the operational dynamic of a foreign exchange program. For one, the criminal background checks rely on reported behavior, and also, too, that the criminal background check would be done before the student actually arrives, the host family. In many instances, for example, with Rotary International, students have three different host families throughout the year, and that's the way Rotary operates. AFS is different. When a student comes for a year, we like to place students in a family for 1 year. What this would mean would be continual ongoing background checks for everybody in the family over that age. And to boot, there is no substitute, we believe, at AFS for that local contact.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I'm not suggesting this is a substitution for anything else.
Correct.
I think it's offered as one additional tool where information would be gleaned that wouldn't happen through any other way. I just don't understand why you don't want the added protection of the background check.
We don't believe that it would protect. We actually believe it would lend even perhaps a false sense of security to the situation that the child is in and the host family as well. The other thing is, too, is when a student comes from another country and lives in the United States with a host family on an AFS program, they're actually part of a larger community. Students are placed in pods where other students are located. There are orientation screenings. And so the students are involved in a supportive community. And we actually believe that this is really going the wrong direction and that it would be a... It would create a false sense of security. I spoke yesterday, too, with Andrea Morgan from the Department of Education, and the Department of Education is not supportive of background checks at all, because one of the things that this bill would require would be for the Department of Education to actually do duplicate work, what CSIET is doing. In other words, spot checks and making sure that the situation is good and that the student is in a supportive environment. And then to take appropriate action for organizations that are non-compliant. And to that extent, the Department of Education is not behind the background checks because they...
Madam Chair, is it an issue with you as far as the expense of the background checks?
As far as I know, with the bill as it was originally drafted, there are no known costs whatsoever. There are going to be costs involved, that is for sure. Who will bear those costs and who will be in charge of maintaining records, again, that already are maintained by the Homeland Security Office now and also by CSIET, is either going to fall to the Secretary of State or to the Department of Education.
Hey, Madam Chair, just so that I really want to focus on this, if you had to say in one sentence what your main objection is to background checks, it would be that provides a false sense of security?
Is that they are unnecessary in the dynamic of a well-run, reputable exchange organization like AFS. I was an AFS exchange student when I was in high school too many years ago, and I remember the screening, the selection, and the support that I got throughout that entire process. And I think part of the issue that we're dealing with are those organizations that are, a number of them, for-profit organizations, unlike AFS and Rotary, where there isn't this motivation to just place students in families because you're getting a certain amount of money for the bottom line. We do this because our mission is international peace. Mm-hmm. And we have some local volunteers here today in the audience.
I just want to cut you off because I guess I want to get to my point. If your main objection to background checks is that they're unnecessary, I guess my response is that 98% of this is unnecessary. We're trying to protect that 2% who may be subject to sexual predators. It just seems to me that it's a pretty small step to take to protect 2%, and that we should be willing to go to that extra, take that extra step. Mm-hmm. But that's just my perspective.
I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. I wanted to clarify one of my comments. Senator Walker pointed out that I got confused in the declaration of criminal activity is not in the dash two amendments. It was in the original bill. My question to you is, have you looked at the dash two amendments and do you support, have you looked at the amendments that we just adopted to the bill and do you support those amendments? Because that's really the subject up for discussion right now.
I have looked at dash two and AFS does support
the
legislation.
Bill as amended?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? Are you done with your formal
question? I am. Thank you very much. Yes.
Are there other questions, Senator Walker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one question. And you asked the question I was going to ask, that you were okay with the dash twos. My question, Mr. Morgan, is, as you know, I've drafted the dash twos because you informed me about the Washington state law. Could you please tell the committee of your knowledge about how that law has worked since its passage in 1991?
Yes. The way the law works is, again, it requires that an international exchange organization operating in Washington State be registered and in good standing with CSIET. CSIET does annual reviews of all exchange organizations. And the Secretary of State receives this compilation, this list of exchange organizations that are in good standing, and disseminates that information to superintendents of school districts throughout Washington State. Part of the process of placing a foreign exchange student in a school district, and when the students do come over, they have to actually be enrolled in a school. They can't just come over and work or live with a family because a J-1 visa is only a high school study program. That form has to be signed and okayed by the school officials. And the school officials in Washington State know which organizations are certified and regulated by CSIET, those federal regulatory agencies. And they will not place students, they will not allow host organizations to operate in their state if they are not in good standing with CSIET. So it's a very cost-effective way to take advantage of those regulatory pieces that are already in place at the federal level, at three different levels really, to ensure constituent safety and actually to ensure that a quality exchange programs happen in Washington State.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Call Tom Rosh from the Corporation Division. Did I pronounce your name correctly? Or near correctly? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Rausch. I'm here on behalf of the Secretary of State's Office and the Corporation Division, testifying before you on the Dash 2 amendments for Senate Bill 553, and the copy of my written testimony is being passed around. We've had a chance to look fairly quickly at the Dash 2 amendments and a check with similar programs in Washington, in Minnesota. Had difficulty reaching California, so I can't speak to those. As we understand the Dash 2 amendments, they create a similar program in Oregon as in Washington, and somewhat similar in Minnesota. And that kind of program, which is primarily a registration program, fits in with our mission and our abilities, and we are quite happy to go that way if the Legislative Assembly sees this as a good policy option. We'll caution you that if we are supposed to be more of a regulatory function in terms of establishing standards and going out and forcing compliance or certification, that is a different a different thing altogether, and will have a significant fiscal impact. It's outside of our expertise, et cetera. We don't believe that the bill in the Dash 2s, as they stand, will have that kind of fiscal impact, will have that kind of impact to us. But I did want to caution you, especially in the discussion about background checks. The way Minnesota does it, which is it has a very similar language to the Dash 2s, except it adds a background check, and perhaps I'm a fool of rushing in where angels fear to tread, but it has a background check in here. But what it says in the statute and in the rule is that the host agency has to has to have an application that asks for a background check, but the organization does not necessarily have to follow through with that. It only gets permission to do a background check. And that may be a compromise. I don't know. I just offer that up as something that's in Minnesota, and I have not looked further than that, just for what it's worth. But I emphasize again, the background check is the burden is placed on the host organization if it's done at all, not with the Secretary of State.
Madam Chair?
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I have a question. Mr. Rausch, I'm intrigued by what you just stated about the Minnesota law. So the Minnesota law gives the host organization the option of placing that information on their application as to and it's discretionary whether they would ask for a background check.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, that's true.
Okay.
I have a copy of the law if you'd like to look at it.
I would. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. I think we'll take Andrea Meyer and Bob Wilner up here together to address the Dash 2 amendments. It might be quick.
Chairman, as members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. We have no objections to the Dash 2. I do have concerns about the original bill as drafted, as been indicated. And one of the things that I don't believe has been brought up, but this is actually not just simply granting authority to do a background check, but a LEDS system check, which my understanding, and certainly the chair can speak more directly to this, is a closed system only available to law enforcement to use, having had the training and terminals that are to which they're certified to be used, and they have the reason. So this is not open to third parties, private entities to come in and look at. And LEDS systems disclose not just convictions, arrests, personal information about people. This bill also sweeps into...
But you're talking about the original...
The original bill. Just my concerns, but if you want me to stop and just limit it to Dash 2, I'll say we have no objections to it.
That's the bill as it now stands, given our work sessions. Any questions in the committee? Mr. Wilner.
Thank you. I'm Robert Wilner, Executive Director of the Oregon International Council, a private nonprofit organization established in 1983 to help strengthen international education in Oregon generally, following recommendations of the Oregon Governor's Commission on Foreign Language and International Studies, that era 20 years ago. One of the functions we've performed in regard to this international education goal has been the annual publication since 1985 of the Oregon International Education Opportunities Directory, and I've made copies available. Those who are interested in seeing it, the directory is paid for by listed organizations and distributed to high schools throughout Oregon and many other recipients, and we think it has probably been a useful tool in strengthening the international exchanges in the state of Oregon. We understand that Pacific Northwest is a leading area in that role, in that regard. And in keeping with the state's interest in this international participation, we're delighted to see the value of international student exchanges affirmed as they are in the amended Bill 553. And we're glad to endorse the principle reflected in that version of requiring exchange organizations to register and follow performance standards that have been developed and recognized nationally. We think that's a very valuable benefit. We've been advised by one or two of the listed organizations that could not be here today of some technical concerns they have with the revised version. If I may put those on record. In Section 1, Paragraph 1B, there's a reference to students entering on non-immigrant visas. I'm advised that there are also students entering on a visa waiver program, and the present language might exclude them. That's a technical detail probably needs to be looked at. Section 3 contains reference to a list of approved organizations to be distributed annually. If inclusion in this list is contingent on registration with the Council on Standards for International Education Travel, it should be noted that process takes 6 months, so there should be some provision for interim additions. Another minor detail. On several locations, as reference to the U.S. Information Agency, which was the relevant agency when the Washington law was passed. It no longer exists. It's been absorbed into the U.S. Department of State. So another technical detail should be attended to, I guess. One other point I received from one of our organizations was the concern that background checks are not that easy, that they involve many different jurisdictions and many different levels and can be quite expensive. And that was their particular concern here. I'm not familiar with the actual situation. If there's just one place you can go to for a limited cost, that might be one thing. If there are half a dozen or a dozen different jurisdictions you have to go to, that could be another problem.
But you do support the Dash 2 amendment.
But the Dash 2 amendment is a fine thing. It establishes the sort of standards that we have hoped there would be in place. The CSIET standards are a very strong benefit in expanding and strengthening the kind of program we'd like to see.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Actually, I just have one. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilner, thank you so much for your helpful instruction on the changes that need to be made. I truly appreciate that. And the question I would have is, since the United States Information Agency no longer exists, should there be some other reference?
I think it would probably be to the U.S. Department of State.
Okay. All right.
I'd want to check and see that the terminology is correct.
You might want to include language like any other successor entity in federal government, in case they move it around. I'm just some catch-all phrase that any other appropriate
there may be a successor. I think this is one for Legislative Council. But I just wanted you to know that the national legal structure has changed. And there had been reference in some bills to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which is now part of the Homeland Defense Department. So the terminology needs to be updated, I guess.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your input.
Thank you very much.
I have Larry Reuter signed up from Criminal Information Services, Inc., but I presume that testimony is related to the original bill and not the Dash 2. Am I correct? Why don't you just come up briefly? And I don't want to waste any of your time if your information applies to the original bill.
My name is Larry Rutter. My residence is 6295 Southwest Tillamook Place in Beaverton, Oregon. Mm-hmm. I'm the president of a company, Criminal Information Services, which was started after I ended a 23-year career in adult corrections, parole or probation, starting as a parole officer, ending up as a deputy director in Washington County Community Corrections. During that time, as with Mr. Cartledge, I had made a lot of observations about predatory sex offenders, and the wide range of the types in that category, and their effect on people, and the desperation of nonprofits for some way to conduct criminal background checks that would be cost-effective, affordable, and timely. Timeliness is important, too. Volunteers can't sit and wait for background checks to take weeks and months to come around.
Mr. Rutter, the reason I made those comments at the beginning is the bill right now does not include background checks, and I wanted to know if you've seen the amendments and have any comments on the amendments, which is the bill before us.
No, the only thing I would say is that one of the databases we have is from Minnesota, and if they use that database to do their criminal background checks, which I understand is an option, kind of a half-hearted way of doing due diligence and screening volunteers, because due diligence is what you're talking about, taking the steps necessary to protect vulnerable people, then I would say that they probably have the right idea, except for the fact that the option to do it is nowhere near as effective as the requirement to do it. And at the rates we charge, and I'm not pushing our service because there are others like ours that have come into play in the last 5 or so years, maybe, it makes it affordable and timely.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions, Senator Walker? Senator McGill?
Thank you. Thank you for coming to testify this morning. I want to ask the question, how much does it cost?
We have... Our database is accessible over the internet, online. Customers register with us, and with security, can go in and do their own, perform their own checks. At that, using that option, it costs them 75 cents to check one individual in one state. We have 32 states right now. Admittedly, some of those databases are not as substantial as they should be, and we quickly point that out to people. Oregon, Washington, Idaho Department of Corrections we have. Those are solid databases. Right now, the Boy Scouts of America in Portland uses us, and they check all three states for $1.50. So we make special arrangements with high-volume customers.
Madam Chair, and for that $1.50, do you want to find out if there's any arrest record at all in those three states?
It would be an arrest that resulted in at least supervised probation.
I see.
Which would have covered all of the crimes listed in the original bill.
I see.
Which is another point I would have made if that bill had remained relevant.
I see.
In that specifying crimes inevitably results in leaving something out that
okay.
you wish you would have covered.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Fetter. Okay. Chairman, would you like to gavel that?
Well, actually, you can conclude this. I'm not sure if you're, in your opinion, the bill's ready to go or not. So.
We will. Senator Walker, it's your wish to address some of these other concerns.
You want to bring it back later?
Yes, Madam Chair. Obviously, from the testimony of Mr. Wellner, there needs to be some technical changes made to the amendments. And I did just want to discuss briefly, if we might, this issue that was just raised by the last witness, that's $1.50 to get this kind of a check, and to look at the Minnesota law and see what their options are.
Okay. Thank you. We'll cross the public hearing then on Senate Bill 553. We will turn the gavel over, and the chairman will announce our next adventure.
Our next adventure, yes. Good. Thank you. Next adventure will be Senate Bill 716. I think everybody who signed up on Senate Bill 716 will have counsel explain what the bill does to us, for us, excuse me, not to us. And we'll see who feels like they want to come up and chat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, this bill, Senate Bill 716, allows so-called linked progressive bingo gaming by charitable, fraternal, or religious organizations. Essentially, right now, bingo games, as I understand it, can be played in one room, one game. This bill would allow multiple games in different rooms, different locations, to all be linked together in one larger game with a larger take at the end, larger stakes. And it's intended to try and increase the number of persons and bring in a younger crowd who are interested in playing bingo. It's my understanding, based on the witness list, that everybody is in favor of the everybody has signed up in for the bill, and Kevin Neely has had to step out to a meeting of the Department of Justice, and he indicated that he was satisfied with the -1 amendments, which you should have in front of you.
All right. So let's talk to you. It's your bill, right? I mean, I introduced it before. Why don't you come on up and tell us why you're doing it, why you want it done, and then we'll look at the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I have some other people from our association here that have signed up to testify, and it's okay if they just join me at the same time.
I'm trying to expedite. Just tell us why you want the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Ennis and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Helen. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Charitable Gaming Association. So, basically, our bill is quite simple. We've been experiencing declining bingo revenues for the charities that operate bingo games in Oregon. For a little statutory information, if you aren't aware, the only people that can operate bingo games in Oregon are charitable organizations. And it's managed by the Department of Justice under the Charitable Activities Division. We've been experiencing significant declines in our bingo revenue over the last 8 years specifically. One of the factors that we've identified is that we need to come up with new, entertaining, and more exciting games to offer people so that we can draw people back and even expand our base of customers. And another factor that has significantly impacted our ability to keep players is the presence of tribal casinos and their ability to offer bingo games with unlimited prize payouts, but also have the type of game that we are looking to bring to Oregon, the Lincoln-style progressive game. I could go into detail for you if you'd like about the type of game, but I understand you're on time crunch. But basically, we worked with the Department of Justice on the language of this bill. We've talked with our member associations, the charities that make up our group, and decided that one of the best ways we could increase our demographics, draw customers back, and help our charities continue to benefit from bingo revenues in Oregon would be to allow Link-style progressive games in Oregon.
Okay, your name again for the record, by the way. It's John Helen, correct? Did you say that? Okay,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm like spaced on everything. The Dash 1 amendments... with the agreement, what do they do?
Essentially, the Dash 1 amendments return the language to what we had originally submitted to Legislative Council that we had discussed with the Department of Justice would be okay with them. The changes that Legislative Council made were not okay with the Department of Justice, so we are changing them back. Basically, it's just some phrasing on page 1. It's just a simple... instead of saying licensed gaming equipment manufacturer, it's any person, which was to take in property owners, real property owners, who then lease their buildings to bingo licensees. And just verbiage. It's just what the Department of Justice wanted.
So the Department of Justice, I assume, wanted to narrow it to a very specific group as opposed
Correct.
To a very broad language that could encompass a number of people. All right. Members? Senator Rinko?
All right. Do people become addicted to bingo like they do other games and gambling behavior?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, I have brought prepared testimony. I forgot to give it to the clerk, but on the back of my prepared testimony, you'll see that I've given you some statistics on the fact that 83% of people play bingo for entertainment and excitement. Only 13% play it for money. It's a social event. We don't really have an indication that there is a gambling problem when it comes to bingo players. More than anything, it's people come together, sit at their same table, have their time to get together. One of the downsides of our industry at this point is that it has been traditionally more of a senior activity where seniors get together, especially where so many of our licensees are senior centers. They get together and play for social activity, a social event, and we're just trying to reinvigorate our industry to draw in new customers for the entertainment side, not necessarily the gambling side.
Yes, Senator Ringo.
Well, if it were just social, then I don't see why you'd be facing competition from casinos.
Well, certainly there is an element there of the type of game that's played, and certainly there is an element of a prize, but we are facing, for instance, we have a bingo hall in Northeast Portland, the Disabled American Veterans Hall, where one of the tribal casinos drops a bus off 2 blocks from our hall and picks up our players and ships them to their casino to play, gives them free food, free drinks, free money to play. So there certainly is that element of competition when it comes to the prize payout. There's no question of it. But when you have a free trip offered and the opportunity to earn, you know, if you're going to play bingo, you want to play for the best money you can get. So there certainly is that element of competition that we do need to level the playing field for.
Level playing field. I've heard that before.
Thank sure you have, Senator Ringo. Thank you.
Any other questions by members? Senator Walker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I want to thank Senator Ringo because my eyebrow went up yesterday when Mr. Helen came into my office to talk to me about this bill because I do get concerned when we promote more gambling than we have, and I have no problem with gambling. It just sort of this whole idea of some progressive bingo thing sounded really huge, and it's not. And so I appreciate that explanation you've given today.
Probably a really good place to go get votes.
Yeah, absolutely. Good place to do a registration drive center.
All right. Is it committee? If it's a committee, is okay with doing a work session? Sorry, Senator.
I just want. I'll make the motion for the Dash One Amendment. And if you need a bill to get this out of committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me.
Hang on a second, Senator. Pretty finish and then.
I'm willing to do that if that's your wish. I just wanted to register that I'm just not comfortable with the proliferation of gambling in general.
That's why I voted for the lottery back in 1985, I think. So
I voted against the lottery, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I mean on the floor of the House. All right. Okay. So let's do a brief work session. We're going to adopt the Dash One Amendment, if possible. Senator Ferriola.
I just was noticing the wild gesticulations of a citizen in the audience that seems to want to offer some testimony on this bill.
Yeah, I understand. We're going to give him a chance. I would never offend Justin. Not intentionally. Not intentionally. Because I've seen his golf, and I've golfed with him before, and he could be a hazard. Anyway, fine. We're in a work session on Senate Bill 716. Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the Dash One Amendment. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. All right, we have the Dash One Amendment. Justin, come on up here. Now, did you sign up?
I didn't. I missed the sign up sheet, and I talked with Mr. Helen earlier.
My name is Justin Martin. I'm with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde.
You're not going to try to throw a baseball stadium in here, are
you? No, I certainly will hold that for a different argument and a different office within this building. Again, my name is Justin Martin. I'm with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. We have no position to this bill as of yet. I talked with Mr. Helen this morning. But as seeing that we were included within his testimony, I wanted to make sure to let the committee know and clarify just a few things with respect to charitable and nonprofit organizations. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, we have no position on this bill, but I think the end goal when it comes to charities and nonprofit organizations is being able to deliver a revenue stream and to being able to accommodate those services. I'm very proud to say this May, the Spirit Mountain Community Fund, which dedicates 6% of our net profits to nonprofit and charitable organizations, will have contributed their 20 millionth dollar over the last 5 years. Now, in looking at the testimony from the Charitable Gambling Association, we see that there has been a decline, but I want people to know this isn't about competition. This is ultimately about delivering those services and those revenues to those charities and those nonprofit organizations. So whereas there may be a specific decline of maybe $500,000 here in the testimony today, specifically to fiscal year 2001, it is fact that the Spirit Mountain Community Fund in that fiscal year delivered over $4 million to charitable organizations and nonprofits within an 11-county service area. And mind you, that's only one of the eight tribes that has a compact with the state of Oregon to deliver those services. So again, we don't have a position specifically to this bill, but I wanted to make sure to let the committee know that, again, this is not about competition. This is about the delivery of revenues and services to charitable and nonprofit organizations. And you can see that the tribes throughout Oregon have done more than their share to make up for that lack of funding that may have been seen because of our facilities. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Comments. I appreciate it. Anybody else wishing to testify on this that feels absolutely compelled to do so? All right. If not, we're at a work session, I guess. Are you going to vote against it?
Yes, I do have to move it, but I would like to vote against it unless you'd like a courtesy vote.
Okay, we'll see. Could you make a motion?
Yes, I'll make the motion. We already passed the Dash Ones, correct?
Yes, we did.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair, I would make the motion to pass Senate Bill 716 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker then moves Senate Bill 716 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Senator Burdick, your objection is noted. Any other objection as to the bill?
Mr. Chair, I didn't want to thank Mr. Martin. I think he's left the room for his comments about his chair. His comments about the charitable contributions that Spirit Mountain and the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde had made to the state of Oregon.
All right, thank you very much. There's one objection to the bill, Senator Stark.
I'm going to vote yes, okay. But I reserve the possibility that I may
vote against it on the floor. That's fine. Okay, the motion passes. Senator Burdick dissenting. And we have a few more minutes. Do you want to do the genetic privacy bill or wait? They would really like to do it. They would really, really like it. Let's see if it unravels right in front of them. What's the bill number? 6:18, public hearing. Come one, come all, come forward. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.
Who is carrying
the bill? I'll carry the bill. I'll carry the bill we just passed out. 7:16. So Senator Burry can beat up on me again. You're with me. All right. Council, what does the bill do?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 618 modifies Oregon laws related to genetic privacy and clarifies requirements for the use of genetic material in research.
All right, thank you. And Andrea, are you going to testify also?
The bill should pass.
The bill should pass. Okay. Go ahead.
That's my message to Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ted Falk, and I'm an attorney, and I'm appearing here today as co-chair of the Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research, and several other members of the committee and the other co-chair are with me today. We previously presented to you about a month ago our overall a report on the state of genetic privacy in Oregon. And what we're here for today is the specific piece of legislation which we're recommending for enactment in 2003. Just in brief, this legislation was enacted in 1995, went through a major overhaul with a lot of policy issues in 2001. This bill, by contrast, is relatively a technical cleanup bill of an existing piece of legislation. The main focus of the present legislation is to clarify the conditions under which biomedical research can be done using genetic materials that have been either coded or are anonymous. I believe it is the case that there is a consensus on this bill. The bill itself consists of Senate Bill 618, and then we want to recommend adoption of the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments were an earlier draft, so I think that everything is rolled into the Dash 2 amendments.
Can you speak to the Dash 2 amendments and what they do?
The main effect of the Dash 2 amendments is to clarify several of the transition clauses. There's been a lot of discussion about the applicability clause, and there was a lot of specific concern in the committee's recommendations about the applicability of the legislation, particularly in the case of doing biomedical research on genetic materials that have been gathered in the past under circumstances where the notification and consent requirements of the current law had not been followed. So basically, the intent of the Dash 2 amendments together with the bill is to allow anonymous or coded research to occur on past samples, but to impose stricter consent and notification going forward.
All right.
I would be prepared for doing a section-by-section analysis, but maybe in light of the hour, we can just go to the other witnesses and dispense with
it. I think what I want to do today is, because it is a somewhat complex bill, I want to move to do a little adoption of the Dash 2, and I think we'll do a hand-and-gross version of the bill and then give the committee time to review what we're doing here so we don't inadvertently make a mistake or do something that's unintended. Okay, we could do a work session on 6:18. Senator Brady, you got a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 618.
All right, Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 618. Is there discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. We'll bring this back then with a hand and growth version, go through section by section, make sure we
we're comfortable with what we're doing. So we'll try to bring it back sometime next week. Council.
If it might be possible for one of the witnesses to bring maybe a written section-by-section analysis,
yes,
then I could actually assist the committee in going through it,
yes,
and see if they have questions ahead of time and make you aware of those. Does that make
yes,
sense?
Yes, I would have done that today, but until I saw the Dash-2s, I didn't know how it was going to look. So.
All right, good. So we'll get a hand of growth section-by-section and march down that road,
yeah,
as long as the committee is comfortable. Thank you. I appreciate your willingness to wait so long. Unfortunately, sometimes you have no control over where bills go or how they evolve. So, but thank you very much, and we're going to be adjourned.